To begin.
Hey, what is up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Primate Podcast. We got the one and only, the powerful Dan Chambers in the building. What's up, Dan?
Not too much, Eddie. How you doing tonight, man? Thanks for having me. I appreciate this.
Man, thank you for making the time. I know you've been having a couple hectic last couple weeks, couple days. I know today was pretty heavy on just your commute overall. So thank you for making the time to come out tonight.
No problem, man. I didn't want to miss this.
With that being said, man, I mean, I really do want to start just getting to the point. You know, I want to hear that from you directly, kind of how you've been in the game at this point for so long in the legal game and kind of seeing how that process has been for you.
Well, it's funny because I think I've been in the legal game probably longer than you've been alive, and that makes me really old. It's been a diverse 32 years. I came out to LA to go to law school in 1988, and I moved out here from the Midwest. And it was interesting moving to LA. I live in the middle of Koreatown. I had no car. Can imagine living in the middle of LA with no car. And because my parents really didn't have much. I had to kind of work and earn my way through undergrad, law school. So when I got out of undergrad and I was applying to law schools, I really didn't have a lot of financial capabilities. So it kind of limited where I could go. And Southwestern University in the middle of LA, which is kind of on Vermont and Wilshire, it's near Koreatown, offered me a full tuition scholarship. So I was like, man, you know, to go to LA from Iowa, cold winters. Yeah, I'm down with that. So I moved here, went to law school, met my wife, put down roots. And then I started the DA's office, actually, in LA County in 1991. It was a really interesting time in a lot of ways, too. We've come full circle in the 30 years since I've been there. But I started in 91. I left the office in 97. When I left the office, I was a hardcore gang prosecutor. I was handling gang cases in Compton. Most of my time in the office was spent there. Compton in the 90s, as you might imagine, was crazy.
Right.
There were a lot of homicides. We were very busy. Our unit just had more work than we can handle. And I saw, we lived through some pretty crazy stuff back then. You know, we had the LA riots in 92. I remember vividly that day I was working in Compton, and my boss came in and said, hey, you know, everybody's got to go home. Mm-hmm. And we were, of course, watching on TV, but he's like, yeah, everybody's got to get home. So we left the office at like 2. So, you know, I was a DA, a prosecutor during the riots. So I was watching, obviously, the Rodney King case and things like that with great interest. We had the O.J. Simpson trial in 1994, which, of course, divided the city of L.A. Along racial and other lines. That was an interesting time to be a prosecutor while that case was being prosecuted in the office. So a lot of crazy stuff happened when I was there. And this through a matter of circumstances, I left the office. I was in civil practice for many years, but then about 10 or 11 years ago, I really decided my highest and best use in the law is in the courtroom, trying cases and representing individuals that need a voice, need an advocate. So I started my own practice. It just took off immediately, grew really fast, faster than I could handle. So I brought on some extra help, got an attorney that works with me now, an associate. So the last couple of years, to close off your question, I've started to do a lot more post-conviction work. So California has been in the middle of a big criminal justice reform in the past 10 years. We've kind of come full circle. When Pete Wilson was the governor back in the 90s, it was all about three strikes. It was about mass incarceration, lengthy prison sentences. I think in large part because we just didn't know any better. That just seemed to be the easy fix, right? Just lock them away, forget about them. But over the past 10 years or so, between Governor Brown and now Governor Newsom, the legislature's passed a lot of criminal justice reform bills because we understand the value of rehabilitating inmates and trying to integrate them back into the community. So I've been doing a lot more of that work. And if you've done any research on me, you've seen that I've gotten guys out of prison, and there's nothing, to me, there's no better and higher use for a law degree than to literally give somebody their life back. Right. Some of my clients were looking at life without parole. They've been sitting in prison 10, 20, sometimes 30 years. And to be there when they walk out of prison, and then you see them hug their mother for the first time in 20 years as a free person, that does something to you. It changes you, changes my outlook. And there's nothing more rewarding than that. And then to see them succeed on the outside, that's just the icing on the cake.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's just kind of a, in broad strokes, my highest and best use, like I said, is trying cases to juries, persuading juries. But the post-conviction work has been kind of a nice kind of side gig that I picked up that's very rewarding in its own way.
Do you think, feel like it's taking a toll on like, your mental health overall? Like just having to deal with all these cases, all these emotions, like what does that do to you?
It's interesting you ask that because, you know, I'm 57. I'm not a young man anymore. I feel young, but it's interesting because a lot of criminal defense attorneys that I consider, you know, close friends, colleagues, they're sort of like talking about retirement, you know, they're, you know, kind of tired of the grind. But I've got all this energy because I've only been doing criminal defense on my own for, what, 11 years now. And for me, it was like a shot in the arm. It was like an adrenaline shot. And I have tremendous amounts of energy. I don't know where I get it. But you would think it would get to you after a while, but it really doesn't. Every case is different. They have new challenges, different challenges. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you I married the right woman because, you know, and Z's here too. She came with me and she's really kept me balanced. She really helps me understand and delineate between work life and then coming home and being a father to my girls, being a husband to her. So she's really helped keep me on point with knowing, you know, the differences and letting things go. And she also runs the office. So we have a vested interest in the firm together. And, you know, if your mental health isn't right, the firm's going to suffer too. So we've made a big effort on trying to make work work and then home as our home life. Because I deal with a lot of awful cases. Most of my cases are life cases, people facing life in prison, third strikes, murders, gang shootings, sex crimes, you know, very stuff that would wear a lot of people down. But I've got the right team around me. I've got a great partner and we just make it work.
Yeah, that's crazy because, I mean, the most I get out of these things is when I go and read the report or like a summary of what they're going through or what the trial was like. And just reading that, sometimes it gets a little overwhelming, like what's going on, right? And you're just getting a piece, a fraction of what's actually happening. So somebody who's on the ground, just like yourself, having to deal with evidence, having this research, and again, making all these connections, it's like, fuck, you know?
You know what? You try really hard not to get personally invested. You always... You know, you try to pretend like you're the surgeon, right? You're just, you've got the person on the table and you're just doing the heart surgery and you're going to sew them up and then they're going to go home. And you try really hard, but when you care as much as I do and you become such an advocate for the client and you spend so much time with them, there's a, you know, you develop a lot more empathy as a defense attorney than you do a prosecutor. Prosecutors look at it as a case. So when they're done with their murder case, they move on to the next case. And I did that. I was guilty of that. But on the defense side, the calculation's all different. You've got a living, breathing human there.
Yeah.
They've got family that they want to get home to. They may have a partner or children that they want to get home to, and they're looking at, you know, 50 to life, and they're counting on you. I mean, this is your job to make this outcome the best that you can. And you spend so much time with them that it really is hard to just keep them at a distance. And I think a lot of clients, they don't like that. I mean, they want to feel like, okay, yeah, you're my advocate. I know it's a business on some level, but I need to know that, you know, you're truly invested in me and what I have going on. And so you do end up getting to know your clients really well. And for the most part, for me, I've enjoyed that because when the case is over, I've got a new friend, you know, I've got a whole group of people that I got to know through that case. So it's a lot different on this side of the table. And for me personally, just the kind of person I am, it's a lot more rewarding for sure.
Yeah. I mean, and I think about it, like, let's say the people who for some reason can't just like afford an attorney or a lawyer. I mean, for the most part, there is a public defender set up, I guess, for these type of cases, right? But
right.
I'm assuming they're like overwhelmed for other people who may not be in the position to have resources.
Yeah, the public defender, I mean, they're attorneys. That's a common misconception. I get calls all the time into the office and they'll say, I'll say, who's currently representing him? Does he have an attorney? Well, no, he's got the public defender. And I say, well, you know, they're attorneys and some of them are actually very good, but they're overworked. You know, the resources are not there. and they have a lot of cases to juggle. So you're just probably not going to get the personal attention that you would. And it's not because they don't want to, they just don't have the time. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of friends that are public defenders and have a lot of respect for what they do because they really are stretched thin. But it's luck of the draw. You know, you may get a good one and you may get that bad one. So that's kind of the unknown when you, yeah, when you have court appointed at counsel.
Now, you know, I've been lucky enough right now, knock on wood, that I haven't had to, you know, I've been in a position where I have to like ask for legal help. Mm-hmm. For people in the similar position, like what is something that you should expect when that, you know, when you need to make that call? Like, what does that process look like?
As far as trying to identify somebody to represent you?
Yeah, exactly.
Boy, there's a lot of factors that go into it. You know, the main thing you want to know is what their experience level is, mm-hmm, obviously. Reviews are incredibly important. You got to be careful with reviews. You know, we all know that people have fake reviews written for them, at least in my line of work. There's attorneys that literally have, you know, fake reviews and written, and then they post them, you know, on their website or on Google as if they are a review. So reviews are only good so far, but I will say that the reviews that we've gotten, and we have a lot of them, and they're thankfully all very good. People pay attention to those. They rely on those. Yeah. But I think that's just the first step. The main thing I can say is that you have to meet them in person. Don't give them money just over the phone. You know, say, well, this person sounds good enough. I'm going to go ahead and hire them. Mm-hmm. That's really dangerous. I really think you need to sit down and take the time, because especially if it's a case of any level of seriousness, you want to make sure that you vibe with that person. Because I've had people come into the office that really want to hire me, but I don't really want them as a client. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like I meet them and I'm like, I don't know, man, something doesn't feel right here. And I end up passing. Not because I don't want to help them, but just I'm like, this fit's probably not going to work.
Yeah.
So I think until you meet them in person, it's really hard to know if you're hiring the right person. You just have to rely on your gut instincts, which nowadays we don't trust, right? We like to do, mm-hmm, research. You go on Google and you, yeah, know, you go to Wikipedia and you read all this stuff and you start to doubt your own instincts. But on some level, we're all human. We all have instincts, and most of the time our instincts are right, but we find ways to talk ourselves out of what our initial reactions are or our initial impressions. And so until you meet that person one-on-one and you get to know them, it's really hard to know if they're the right attorney for you. So that's the best advice I can give, is identify kind of your top two or three and go see them in person, mm-hmm, make an informed decision.
I don't know. I feel like it's very unjust sometimes that you're just kind of put into the position again where you just have to react and you have limited choices and now you're just stuck with whatever you fucking decided. And a lot of people in my general area, let's talk about that, like, you know, for the most part, they're considered low income or we're in low income areas.
Yeah. And you had written down when you sent me some notes to consider, but you had asked me, in what ways does the economic status of a person impact their experience within the criminal justice system from arrest to sentencing? And that's a deep question, brother, because as much as we'd like to think it's not the case, a lot of times what you can afford really does affect the outcome you get on your case.
Yeah.
It's not as simple as saying, you know, if you've got money, you know, you're golden and you're going to get through the system and, you know, a slap on the hand or whatever. But what it does allow you to do is hire somebody of high quality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I can never make guarantees about how cases are going to turn out, but people that hire my firm know that they're going to get the absolute highest quality defense they can get. And the result they get, many times I can't control. I can't control what 12 jurors are going to do on a case. So unfortunately, I mean, it does play a huge factor. I see people that come in all the time that have hired a very cheap, inexpensive attorney or a firm, or they go hire one of these billboard firms that are outside here on the freeway, and they get in there and they're profoundly disappointed. Because they're not even really many times dealing with lawyers. They're dealing with paralegals or, you know, a case manager, and they don't even get to talk to a lawyer. And they know very little about their case. They're really kind of left in the dark about, you know, what's the evidence against me? And they're kind of, mm-hmm, told, well, this is what you have to do. This is your only choice on the case. And unfortunately, that's what they can afford. So that's the quality they get. So it has a huge impact from arrest to sentencing. And it's unfortunate that it's like that. But many times, if you can afford to hire a private attorney, you are going to get better attention. Your defense is going to get worked up more. You're going to be treated better for the most part, and hopefully get a better result better result because of that. But it has a huge impact. And my wife and I see this a lot in our practice. There are firms out there that I think a lot of times take advantage of, especially Spanish-speaking families. We had a family a couple of years ago that really wanted to hire us. They came in late. They had already hired another firm. I won't mention the firm's name, but they're very prominent Hispanic advertising. They're on buses and billboards and such. And they came in and they told us they wanted to hire us, but then I asked them how much they had paid this other firm. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked at how many tens of thousands of dollars they had spent. And their loved one had been in custody for, I think, almost 2 years, had gotten one visit from a lawyer. It was a different lawyer every time he went to court. Mm-hmm. And all they cared about was the money, you know, make your monthly payment. And they would get threatening phone calls if their payment was a couple days late. And they were just completely taken advantage of. This firm had not worked the case. They hadn't done anything. They hadn't done any investigation. They were just collecting the money and just kicking the case down the road. And then eventually that family wasn't able to make a payment, so they dropped them. Mm-hmm. But then they came and they wanted to hire me, and they had spent all their money. And I said, well, unfortunately, I can't help you. Yeah. I mean, I can't take the case for free, and you've already paid so much money to this other firm. And it was a kind of a very ruthless business model. Mm-hmm. That same firm, by the way, ironically, came in to hire my firm, and it was a domestic violence case. And the husband and wife came in to meet with us, and they had initially consulted with this same firm. And the wife told me this story. They were both in the room together, and I was getting a feel for the case and get a feel for them as people. And the wife told me that when they consulted this other firm, they met with these big billboard firms, a lot of them, you meet with like a salesperson. It's like buying a car. Mm-hmm. They're there to close, they're closers. So they're not lawyers. They're not paralegals even. They're sales agents. They're just like talk to you, give you the little razzle dazzle. And they say, hey, sign this contract. Most of the contracts are in English. Most of them are in tiny font. And many of those clients don't read or understand English, but they're given an English contract that's very complicated. And they sign it without really knowing what they're signing, and it affects their ability, for example, to get money back if they're unhappy and things like that. Kind of taken advantage of. But she told me, because she is the one that called the police. This guy came home drunk. They got into it a little bit physically. She calls the police. They go to interview with this firm, and this person sitting across from them that was trying to sign them up blamed her, and they told her, well, now because you've called the cops, your husband's going to get raped in jail because of you. Damn. And I'm just like, what kind of sales tactic is that? Like, I don't get that. And I just thought that was really twisted for them to tell her that. But that was the kind of tactic they were using to say, you really need us because by your actions, now your husband's going to get raped in jail. And I'm like, are you kidding me right now? And so... that's just a long-winded answer to your question, but it really does make a huge difference. And unfortunately, people a lot of times just don't have the means to hire us. But when we tell people, when they do hire us, many times they come in deep because everybody's passing around the hat, to put money in. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole family contributes. And so many of them want to come in and meet us because they say, hey, if I'm going to pay you some money, I want to meet you, which we have no problem with. And I see the hard work that people put into raising that money just to hire us. And I take that very seriously. That's almost sacred to me that you're going to invest that money. And I know how hard you've worked to earn it just so you can pay it. And you probably need it for other stuff, but you're putting that on hold to hire us. Yeah. To me, like I said, that's almost a sacred thing now. I have to make sure that I do right by this person because I know the effort they've made and the sacrifices to hire us. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a deep thing if you really want to take this beyond the level of just being a business to make some money off people.
Damn, that's fucked up. You know, I was watching this documentary a few days ago on Vice about like the bail bond system and just kind of how it works and, you know, how it's sometimes set up in communities where it's used to take advantage of the people there in their situations.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, it's something that makes about like $2 billion in revenue like every year. So it's like they're making money off of people who are in just situations where they can't afford, especially in communities like this. They're sometimes giving these, you know, this paperwork that sometimes they don't fully understand.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you don't understand these legal terms. Like, you're just going to sign something that you're like, yeah, all right, fuck, this is a short-term solution to my problem right now.
Right.
But then you're not thinking about the repercussions in the long run.
Right. Because when things don't work out and then they go back and they ask me to review the contract to see if they can get money back, usually I have to tell them bad news. Yeah. Say, hey, the way this contract's worded, you're probably not going to get anything back. So it's, yeah, it can be a very dirty business sometimes if that's what you're into. If that's what you're into is just making money off desperate people. And I got to tell you, Eddie, I turn a lot of cases away too, where I know I can't really help that person or that family.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be easy for me to just clip them for a couple thousand and then come back later and say, I can't really help you. But, I'm just not wired like that. Like I said, people work hard for their money. And I want to give them an honest assessment. And if there's somebody else out there that wants to tell them what they want to hear, that's fine. But at least I sleep at night knowing that, you know, I didn't just take a couple grand easy money, you mm-hmm. know, and know that in my heart I can't help them. And you'd be surprised at how many people just throw away money like that. And they come to me and I say, yeah, how much did you, because they come to me frustrated. They say, hey, I paid this other firm all this money. The lawyer didn't do anything. I look at the case and I'm thinking, well, there's really not much to be done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not a lot of hope here for your loved one. But instead of just telling them at the jump, you know, they take all this money and then say later, oh, you know, it didn't turn out well, I'm sorry. And, you know, they threw away all this money. They literally threw it away. So, yeah, it's it can be a crazy business. Bail system you mentioned, and I know you had sent some notes on that. Yeah, that's a very complex question because over the past several years in California, especially, there's been this debate over, are we going to stick with the cash bail system or are we going to go to more like what they have in federal court, which is sort of an assessment of other factors about whether this person should be detained pending trial.
Mm-hmm.
Because in federal court, for example, if the judge determines that based on the factors that judge has to consider that they're going to detain you, you can't post bail. You sit in custody throughout your federal case until it's over. So they don't have really the bail system like they do mm-hmm. for state court and the county level, which ties directly into, you know, this Justice 8 case. You know, the argument that the DA was making or has made in that case to try to keep everybody in jail was to use that sort of new model that the courts are using of, mm-hmm. you know, well, let's make an assessment of, you know, these factors about whether they're a risk to public safety. And if we believe they are, we're going to hold them pending trial with no bail. So California is kind of in the middle. We don't really have clear guidance. We were supposed to get rid of cash bail like 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But the bail bond companies put a ballot proposition on to keep the bail system alive. It passed. So then we were stuck. I shouldn't say stuck, but we were left with cash bail after all.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that the system that the legislature had put into place was going to be great either, because they were going to use a risk assessment tool to evaluate you, for example, or Michael, based on a series of factors and do a risk assessment of, you know, how dangerous you might be and how likely you are to return to mm-hmm. court. The problem was, and the ACLU was very deeply involved in vetting this risk assessment tool, was that a lot of the variables that were being used in the risk assessment tool had underlying implicit bias built into them. So even the risk assessment tool itself was going to disproportionately affect people of color because there was implicit bias sort of built into mm-hmm. the assessment tool itself. So things like, you know, steady employment, you know, what's your income? Well, you know, people of color are going to probably not have the numbers that many other people, right, white people will have. So the risk assessment's going to ding you for that, when in reality, there's a lot of underlying causes about why there is lower income, mm-hmm. and why the work employment history is not as solid. So the assessment tool itself was going to be a problem. So we're left in this weird netherland where bail is still there, but the court's also trying to graft onto it this concept of, well, is this person a risk to public safety? And, you know, from what I could see, I wasn't at the very first hearing when all eight of them were detained without bail. But my understanding from, you know, reading the minute orders and talking to the attorneys that were involved was that the judge basically made an assessment of risk to public safety.
Mm-hmm. Based on their, air quote, actions that they had, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a crazy thing to think about in and of itself. And I've posted on this, and I know you've seen some, but I've gotten people out on bail that have committed extremely violent crimes that you wouldn't want as your neighbor, and they're out on bail. Somebody posted tonight, in fact, I had posted earlier today, and somebody commented underneath the post, I hadn't seen the story because I've been in court all day, but apparently the guy that was arrested for killing, was it Tupac or something? He got out on $750,000 bail, or at least it was set. And somebody commented underneath and said, what the fuck is this? This guy has gotten bail, but these seven are sitting in a jail cell for, you know, protesting, basically.
Yeah.
Stuff that ordinarily they would have been released at arraignment, either on their own recognizance or, you know, given, you know, a GPS monitor or something. It's unprecedented, really, what's happening to all eight of them. Luckily, we got Jag out, but it's come at a high cost for him too. I mean, he's lost his job. The other seven remain in custody, and I know tomorrow afternoon there's going to be some very heated arguments to try to get them out of custody. But it's unprecedented that somebody that has committed the alleged crimes that they've committed are still sitting in there after a month.
To an outsider like myself, I mean, knowing what they've been doing for the community in terms of awareness and like accountability, it just seems to me like it's just a retaliation for what they've been doing. Again, this is just me based on the information that I can only see, but it looks like it's politically motivated in a sense. And that's what, I don't know, I feel like a lot of people get angry about, because it's clear to us what it looks like it's happening, especially with the silencing that we saw recently. I know it's the terms that the court gave Jag and stuff, but not being able to post about anything on Instagram. To us, it looks like some sort of silencing.
It's when you say it looks like it's not looks like it is. And that's an interesting point, and I'm glad you gave me a platform to actually talk about this briefly. You know, some of the people out there, when Jag was released and saw the conditions, you know, there's a lot of keyboard warriors out there. That can pound out any kind of message they want on their laptop or their cell phone about what they think things mean. And, you know, I saw a couple of jackasses that seemed to think, well, you know, he should be willing to just take one for the team, you know, if that's going to be what they're going to ask him to do. That's a violation of his First Amendment rights. Well, okay, maybe it is. But at that time, he had a job to go back to.
Yeah.
He's got a partner he wants to be with. His family wants him home. He wants to be home. So I think it's very easy for somebody, you know, anonymously to comment and say, well, gee, you know, you should be willing to stay in there because everybody else is in there. What the fuck is that? I mean, if you're given a key to go home, are you supposed to stay there on principle just because you can't post on social media? Everybody's situation is different. His calculation in his mind was, I'm better off out there. I can do more good out there than I can sitting in here. And he's absolutely right about that.
Yeah.
And he shouldn't be faulted or criticized for that. That's an individual decision that has to be made by that person. And he could have very easily told me, hey, bro, I can't live with that. You know, if I can't post, I don't want to get out. He could have said that to me, but he didn't. He wanted to go home. His family wanted him home. And that's the price that he has to pay right now in terms of being released. It doesn't make it right.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it not fucked up and a violation potentially of his First Amendment rights. It absolutely is all those things. But people have to make the decision that's best for them in that moment. And I suspect that if bail is going to be considered for the other seven tomorrow, that the judge may very well ask for similar conditions. Mm-hmm. And I can bet you that some or all of those people are going to say, where do I sign? I want to go home.
Yeah,
I've been in here for a month. So it's easy for people to post on social media when they're not the ones sitting in the jail cell.
Now, do these terms apply only while it's still in trial, or is it once it's done and served, then I mean, I'm assuming at that point, there's not like a gag order or anything, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I did get quite a few on that. The duration of the terms really is for the life of the case. Mm-hmm. As soon as the case is over, those conditions go away. Or in fact, I might be able to at some point down the road, once this case is, you know, seasoned a little bit and it's a little older, I can always go back in and ask the court to reconsider and modify those terms. Mm-hmm. A little too fresh right now to do that, but that's always an option too. But to answer your question, it will really last for the life of however long the case is.
The case is. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's what I, to me, was a crazy thing to hear, that initially there was no bail set for any of them just based on, you know, whatever their charges were, which again, from, I know nothing of this, but to me, those charges just seem like not even at a grand scale. Some of them that they were trying to apply did sound a little outrageous, like I think some, what was it, like terrorism or something, or like...
Yeah, criminal threats. They've alleged a kidnapping for one of the instances in Pomona. To me, and I'm, you know, I know the DA would be very, if he was sitting here next to me, would have a very different response. But to me, it's a kind of the ultimate of overreaching to try to create a case. And I said today when I was making my argument to the court to get some of these charges dismissed for JAG, and hopefully we'll know the answer tomorrow about what, if any, will be dismissed. But I told the judge today, it's very clear from the way the prosecutor charged this case that they didn't give any real careful thought to the individual liability or responsibilities of each defendant. They just lumped them all together. It charged them pretty much all with the same stuff. And they're kind of like, well, go fight your way out of it now.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see what sticks. And that's a responsible prosecutor. And I was a prosecutor. And I took a lot of pride in trying to be very fair and very ethical and looking at cases for what they were really worth. I dismissed murder cases I didn't feel like I could prove. I wasn't afraid to do that if I had a reason. I wasn't going to prosecute somebody I didn't feel either perpetrated the crime or I couldn't prove it. And it's up to the prosecutor. That is one of their jobs, to make sure that people are charged fairly. And in this case, they kind of lumped everybody together without looking very carefully at the individual responsibilities of each person. And that's what I found particularly offensive. We took 4 days of testimony in this preliminary hearing, and this morning was the fourth day, and I sat through 3 days of that hearing before I heard a single word about what my client supposedly did. Mm-hmm. That's how little he has involvement in the grand scheme of this whole thing, and it's come at a dear price for him. So it is very crazy how it's all been charged and overcharged just as a way to, like you said, silence them. They're off the streets right now. They're not able to be activists. They're not able to protest what they want to. But more importantly too, and this came out at the preliminary hearing when some of these videos were played, they're not some roving, unruly mob. A lot of these incidents that Alex and Amarado was involved in, especially the one in Pomona, you know, there were people there, this John Doe one that we heard so much about in court, that, you know, in my view, watching the videos, was actually kind of the initial aggressor in this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a single video played in court where anybody in that group said anything racial. What I did hear was that guy making gratuitous comments about, quote, Mexicans. So that was before everything got heated.
Mm-hmm.
So these things didn't happen in a vacuum. These people didn't just show up at Pomona PD to raise hell for no fucking reason. I mean, there was stuff that happened before that escalated this whole thing. And that's the part that the DA and everybody else that's not really intimately involved with the case or isn't aware of what all the facts are, they don't see that part of it. And, you know, there were a lot of antagonists out there to try to get these people in trouble, and they succeeded, and they got the DA to pick up this case.
Now, going on that, like, for the evidence that you're saying right now, like, they haven't seen that part of it. Like, I have a vague idea of who John Doe 1 is, just because I followed Eden Alexis and Amorado's page for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been kind of knowing what kind
his
of
name,
happens.
His real name's out there. I mean, it's not
a
secret.
And, you know, I've seen videos, and if it is a person I'm thinking about, there is a lot of videos where they show the aggression. Even before they got involved, it was happening outside to other people, which is why,
you know,
the competition
led up. Yeah, the initial encounter with the street vendor was... was very heated. I mean, mm-hmm. that guy came out and came at them, you know, very aggressively. So that's the part that people aren't being told yeah. or that we're not focusing on, that kind of was the flashpoint for mm-hmm. everything that came after.
Do they not use those videos as evidence to like show out the character of this person, be like, hey, well, look at this person, how they were compared to how, you know, let's say Jagan, for example, you know, like two differences in character. Mm-hmm. Like, wouldn't that help in some form?
Well, it does. And that's why it was important for us to take the time that we did to play all the videos mm-hmm. And put everything in context. Because you can't let the prosecutor sort of pick and choose what they want to show and show only parts of videos without telling the whole story. Right. And the flip side of that's also true. They didn't play in the preliminary hearing the videos of Jag's encounter with the person that he got into an altercation with. They didn't play those videos. And I commented to the judge that, you know, it's my belief that the reason those videos weren't shown is because it shows how little my client's involvement really was.
Yeah.
And his interactions with this guy are nothing close to what the DA is trying to make them. And that's why they didn't show you the video, because you would have watched it and said, oh, well, it doesn't look that bad to me.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't allow them to pick and choose. You have to call them on everything.
So when you don't have this type of representation for somebody to like, defend you, like what happens? I mean, you get set up with the public defender, again, like mm-hmm. we mentioned earlier, and then you just sit and wait till they have a resolution or.
I mean, I think some public defenders do. I mean, some of them are very dedicated. They're very good. They're very thorough. But you just don't know what you're going to get, you know, because
yeah.
for every one that's really good, you're going to get the one that doesn't give a shit, that's going to retire in 2 years and they don't really care. So you don't know what you're going to get. And that's what makes being represented by the public defender, you know, kind of a crapshoot at times. But like I said, at the outset, I have a lot of friends that are public defenders. They're very dedicated people. They're great at what they do, but they only have an emotional reserve of so much, you know, that they can take on. And that's what makes it a little scary. Fortunately, in this case, people have been willing to step up and represent the defendants. And I know that there's been fundraising going on. And, you know, myself and others in the case were willing to take this case on because we believed in it. And we believed in the defendants. We believed in the clients. And at some point, it's about doing the right thing. It's not about, well, how much money can I make off this case? Because I know for a fact that a lot of us are not charging what we normally would because we do believe in this case and we don't want them to be left on their own to try to figure out how they're going to get a good lawyer to go fight for them. So we've got a good team on board. We work really well together. So far, you know, things are going as well as they can. I just hope they can get out. You know, that's the goal here.
Why do you think it took so long for the media to kind of like, I know we mentioned, or you mentioned to me earlier that we had Primer Impacto from Univision, like finally come on and start like getting some exposure on this. But do you think there's a specific reason why other outlets haven't picked it up? Like, is it just not interesting or like what we're seeing?
It's tough. I would be speculating about that. I know Sal Duran very well. I've had some other cases with him that he's covered very closely. So when I got hired on, my wife suggested, hey, you know, make sure you call Sal. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? That's a good idea. Because I hadn't really seen any coverage on Spanish networks since they had been arrested, other than the fact they were arrested. You know, after that, you know, the interest goes away. And I talked to him and he said, you know what, as soon as I get back from, he was gone, it was a holiday, he was on vacation, and he said he would get out there. And I got a text from him this morning and he said they would be in court. So now we have to make sure that they continue to stay interested in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I told Sal, I said, you know, you guys should be involved in this. There's no reason you shouldn't be. You know, this you know, affects the Hispanic community. It's a huge demographic for your station. People need to know about this case. And the only thing I can figure out is, you know, maybe if this was happening in downtown LA, maybe the interest would be there.
Yeah.
But it's in fucking Victorville, dude. You ever been to Victorville?
just through passing, yeah.
No, but you ever spent time there?
Never.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Maybe it's because it's in Victorville, right? Yeah. It's tucked away.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just like, oh, you know, it's out there in Victorville. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a backwater place, and let's just, you know, it's just not that interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, the grassroots effort to get them out there has paid off, and they finally showed up today. I was able to see the story that ran on their show at 5 o'clock. And it's good that the story is getting out there, but now we got to keep that momentum. We have to keep the pressure on for them to pick up this case and follow it all the way through so that they can really see what's going on here. Because what's going on is just on a human level is not right. You know, legally, that's a different conundrum, how we figure out the legal issues and the problems. But on a fundamental moral level, what's going on out there with these individuals is not right.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the bail thing again, that seems crazy to me. Like, you think as a normal person, like, bail is like
almost a right.
Yeah, exactly.
And on some level, it is a right. I mean, the Constitution does provide for bail, the right to bail. California Constitution provides that right, except in death penalty or special circumstance murders. But with that exception, bail is in the Constitution. However, we do have this sort of other line of cases that has now sort of started talking about the protection of the public and whether this person's a risk to public safety, such that, you know, bail shouldn't be set, or bail should be set in a very, very high amount that you and I can't afford.
Yeah.
So yes, while it is designated in the Constitution, as we know, sometimes things aren't always as they're written, and there's a whole different layer of laws that now make it very difficult in certain cases to get bail that have nothing to do with your financial ability to pay for it. You have people making decisions about you based on, you know, other things, your background, your criminal history, your what the crimes are that you've been accused of. But even given all of that, the folks in this case should have been released a long time ago based on what they're charged with.
Question for bail, do you get that back after the case is done, or how does that work?
Why, did you just have to pay bail or something?
I'm trying to get that money back.
Yeah, is that what you're asking me? No, the way bail works is think of it as an insurance contract, like you would have on your car. Mm-hmm. Basically, bail is a guarantee that you'll come to court when you're supposed to.
Okay.
So it's like an insurance policy, and if you're arrested and the bail's designated at, let's say, $30,000, the bail company is going to charge you a percentage of that.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the bail company you work with, it could be as high as maybe 10%. It could be as low as 3%, 4%, 5%. Just, you know, bail companies are in competition with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever money you do put up, whatever percentage that is, you're not going to get back, because that's the price tag for you to get out of jail. Think of it that way, because the bond company is then on the hook for the entire $30,000.
Ah.
So if you jam to Mexico and you never come back, they are going to lose their $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when you sign up for bail, somebody else is going to sign on that dotted line with you, because if you do jam to Mexico, they're going to come after mom, they're going to come after brother, they're going to come after your wife or whatever to get their $30,000 back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that's when you get bounty hunters and stuff like that looking for people. If it's a big enough, if it's a big enough amount, you got bounty hunters out looking for you. But that's the way bail works. It's just an insurance policy, but the money you put up, you're not going to get back.
Right, yeah. But the idea is that you have the bail as an incentive to keep going to your dates, right?
Well,
is that what I mean?
They go to the bail bond company that you call, that you go down the street, that writes the bond. They're tapping a much larger insurance company that's got a huge reserve of, you know, $500 million or something sitting there, or $1 billion to write bonds, right? So the local guy, he's just making money off the premium. Right.
Okay.
So if he writes 10 bonds that month and he's charged 5% on all of them, that's the money that he gets to run his business.
Mm-hmm.
But he's tapping a surety company or an insurance company that has much larger capabilities. They're the ones putting the money into the court.
Okay.
You know, it's a big insurance company basically, and he's making money off the premium. And the premium is really your price tag to get out. So that's why you don't get it back, because otherwise he makes no money. There's no incentive for him to write a bail bond for you if he's not going to be able to keep the premium. And so the premium's gone. And that's why you have to think long and hard about sometimes if you want to bail out somebody at a larger dollar amount, because I mean, if that bond premium's $20,000, $30,000, $40,000,
yeah,
that you're not going to get back. And let's say, go back to your example, that you've got limited finances. People call all the time with this. Well, I have X number of money available and I don't know whether to get bail or to hire a lawyer. And they literally have to choose either or.
Yeah.
You know, that's a tough decision to make. And I always just personalize it because I get people that call. Now that would be very easy for me to say, well, you should hire a lawyer, right? That's serves my interest.
Yeah.
But I always personalize it and I say, look, you know, if my daughter was sitting in jail right now and I only had enough money to get her out, I would get her out. I'll worry about the lawyer later. We'll get the public defender, whatever. But I don't want my loved one sitting in jail.
Yeah.
You know, so for some people, that is literally the choice they have to make.
Damn, man, that's intense. I think I was listening to some report. I think it was on the Vice documentary I saw. Never seen. I think there was an event where in the there was some protests happening out in Baltimore. And I think they took photos of this young man bashing like the windows of a car. They arrested, he turned himself in because he felt guilty about it. They arrested him, put him in jail, and they left his bail at $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
All because he was just destroying property and he was caught while they were doing the protests. And I was like, fuck,
yeah.
500, like, my God, that's $500,000. Like nobody in their right mind in that position, at least, will have that amount of money to just be able to get out, you know? And
yeah, I mean, if that happened around here and then you call a local bail bond company, you know, they're going to say, well, the premium's going to be, let's say, 8%. Well, that means you got to come up with $37,000. But then again, because of the amount of the bond, the risk level goes up for the insurance company that's putting up the money. So in addition to putting up that 37, they may say, well, we need a lien on your house too, you know, because it's got a pencil for us financially. Because if you walk away and we're left holding 500 grand,
yeah, we'll take it and take your house.
And it doesn't matter if you have your father co-sign on this because your father only makes X amount of dollars a year at his job.
Mm-hmm.
We can't have that risk on our books of $500,000. So we need a lien on your house for $500,000. So that way, if you disappear, we'll get your house and we'll get our money back. So, yeah, at that level, it gets real, real fast.
Damn. I mean, I can just think the millions of lives it can destroy, you know, like, or people whose lives have been destroyed just through stuff. Again, like, in Jag's position, like, he got out, but he lost his job, you know? And
yeah.
That's his income, right? His form of making money, of doing what he needs to do. And now that's been taken away. Now he has... Does he have like a, I guess it's like a record, right? Like a criminal or arrest history? Like, does that affect?
Well, he has an arrest. He hasn't been convicted of anything, but he has arrest on his record. And, you know, even having that arrest is going to impact his ability to go get another teaching job, for example. And those are the kind of collateral consequences that people suffer that have nothing to do with the court case. And that's, I guess, why on a personal level, I'm so offended by this case to begin with, because it's really turned his life upside down for what? And nobody got hurt. You know, nobody went to the hospital. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
Of all the charges, there's 17 counts, right? And 8 different people involved in this case. And notwithstanding all of these charges and all the stuff that went down at Pomona and all the stuff that's happened in Victorville, nobody went to the hospital. The DA has not alleged that anybody suffered serious bodily injury or anything else. So even without any significant injuries to any of these folks, they're still sitting there with no bail.
What?
And so it's just, like I said, it's unprecedented. I've never seen it in all the years I've been practicing. I've never seen this. And, you know, then you get into these collateral consequences where he's now lost his job. Now he's got an arrest on his record. And those things are hard to overcome. You know, life is hard enough, you know, without those problems. But now you add those to the mix. And all of a sudden, you know, he's got a difficult time getting back on his feet. And how you think about, how did all that change in just a month or two from the person that we know? I mean, I'm just getting to know him, but I know him well enough to know what he means. Somebody sent me a link tonight to a YouTube video that's out there where he and his partner, Jasmine, put on a kickboxing clinic for these kids over in Fontana. And so... I was being kind of smart ass, but I forwarded it to several people at the firm and people I know that I'm working on this case. And I said, yeah, check out this YouTube video. This is the violent, threatening, racist criminal that I'm defending in court, you know? And he's working with a bunch of little kids on how to do kickboxing, yeah. You know? And then I saw another video somebody sent me when he's being interviewed by the school, and he's talking about his teaching and what classes he's teaching. And it's just crazy that his life could get turned upside down so fast over something so stupid and so minor. And, you know, it's funny because all these, again, these keyboard warriors are saying, well, you know, he associated himself. You know, you can associate yourself with a lot of people, but that doesn't mean that you are the same person as they are. It doesn't mean that you're into exactly the same depth of whatever they're into. I think that he is a person with a social conscience. He's politically aware. He's active. And he's going to end up at the same events that some of these other folks are at, because they're all out there, you know, engaging in activism. Mm-hmm. So you're going to run into the same people. But that doesn't mean that, you know, Alex Enamorado is his best fucking friend and he's going to do whatever Alex says for him to do.
Yeah.
He's a very independent, smart person that, you know, knows what he wants, knows what is important to him. He doesn't need to rely on somebody else. He's not somebody's, you know, stool pigeon that's going to do whatever they want. And so that's, I guess, again, why I get so upset that the DA tries to lump all eight of them together as if they're this, you know, that their own entity. There's this roving mob that's out there doing all the stuff when that's just not true.
Yeah, I noticed that there was a couple of students that were, well, there were students of JAG that showed up to the court today.
Mm-hmm.
And they were there. So that to me speaks volumes, you know, like the fact that you have the people who you were there to inspire and to educate and to influence, like they're there to, you know, be basically a sign of character for what you've done as well.
Yeah. No, I met, I had the good fortune of meeting those students yesterday. One of those students and their parent was there last week as well on Thursday, I think. But I got to meet them yesterday and I was really proud of them for being there and showing their support. It took, you know, a lot for them to do that. And of course, you know, people were saying, oh, you know, they shouldn't be missing school for that. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's a sign of what he means to them. And I think that's why you know, so many people are outraged that he lost his job over this, because he loves what he does.
Yeah.
I mean, this was his calling and that's been taken away from him. And it was really done. I was shown the copy of the email that was sent by the school to him. It's a two sentence email. So after 4 years of service, after 4 years of educating the youth and being such an asset to the community and to that school, he was dismissed in a two sentence email. One, you're terminated effective this date. Two, you can pick up your paycheck here.
Wow.
And that was it. It's fucking cold, dude. They just broke him off like that. And then they sent out this email to the parents that I also saw that somebody posted. And, you know, the way it's worded makes all sorts of terrible implications about him that simply aren't true. And what's upsetting is that the school did that without ever investigating the facts of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody called me. Nobody from the school called me. Nobody said, hey, you know, what is his level of involvement? What are the allegations of what he really did? Nobody took the time to do that. They just fired him. And they didn't bother with trying to put him on administrative leave first, maybe.
Yeah.
Right? Let's put you on leave. Let's sort out the court case. If they weren't even willing to do that, at least do an investigation and get a balanced view of what his involvement was.
Yeah.
They just got rid of him. And I know that now a lot of parents are extremely upset about that because of what he means to their children. And I got a lot of character reference letters that I presented to the court when I got him out on bail. And I read a couple of them out loud to the court, to the judge. And it's crazy how much these parents love him as his teacher and the value he's provided to their children. So you know, all the school has done is damaged a community.
Yeah. No, I mean, definitely. I've met Jack just last year in the summer. So, you know, I've only had a few months of getting to know him. And, you know, stand-up guy, like there's something like inspiring about him, the way he mm-hmm. talks and the way he carries himself. So
exactly. He just gives off an energy.
Yeah. So, you know, when all this happened, that's why I think along with everybody else who's been following the news or the case, they felt like they were wronged first and foremost. Angry, like people feel angry. I know I felt angry when I knew that what was going on. And on top of that, the limited amount of information that we got was more like infuriating, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, again, once you started kind of updating people as well on Jack, we started getting a better sense of what was going on and where they stood and, you know, giving us a little bit of hope in terms of what the outcome was going to be.
Yeah, we're optimistic for a very good result. You know, he wasn't even present during the stuff that happened in Pomona. So the crazy part of it is he's been alleged to be part of a conspiracy with the other seven. Mm-hmm. For things that happened in Pomona where this conspiracy supposedly was hatched at a time when he wasn't even present. He was in Orange County the day of that whole Pomona thing and didn't know what was going on there. And it's crazy to try to say somebody was part of a conspiracy that they had no knowledge of.
Yeah.
To me, that just makes no sense practically and legally. And I'm hoping that the court will see that. But it's crazy. And what's really crazy, Eddie, is that the detective testified in court yesterday that, because they have hundreds of thousands of pages of social media. They did social media dumps on all eight of them. So you can imagine if you extract the data for your Instagram page, it's going to be 30, 40, 50,000 pages if you print it out. So multiply that by eight. And this detective yesterday was up on the stand saying, yeah, I think between myself and the other detectives working this case, we probably have in excess of 1,000 hours spent on this case. And I'm thinking to myself, are you fucking kidding me? 1,000 hours on this case? I mean, so that's time and resources and money that you could be spending on murder cases or, you know, sex cases or human trafficking cases. But you guys are going to put all this time and money and effort into this case.
Yeah.
That just shows you the lengths that they're going to go to make examples of these eight individuals.
And that's a good word, like making examples out of them. And it goes back again to my point, like from the outsider looking in, it looks like, again, some sort of retaliation, you know, because we knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know what they were standing up for, what they would do. And it made us, again, feel a type of way that there was someone, even if it wasn't the cops or anything, holding people accountable for their actions. Which I feel like, you know, to anybody seeing somebody do something right, you start rooting for them, right? So, but when you start seeing these things start happening, we're arrested overnight, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning, I think that's the video that I saw that Enamorado had, like, mm-hmm. you know, you just turn on this phone
They're bringing in SWAT teams. And, yeah. I mean, you think they're taking down El Chapo.
Exactly. Yeah. You're like, what the fuck?
Yeah,
like,
it's crazy.
That's why when you saw it and there was like a whole blackout of everything that was happening for a few days up until I think the Monday where they had their first court appearance, it was like, what the fuck is going on? You know, it just mm-hmm. looked like something from straight out of a movie in that video, just the cops coming into his backyard and taking him out, you know. But yeah, that was like, what the fuck? And this case in general, if anything, solidified their message for accountability and for justice even more. So I mean, at the same time that they arrested them to try to, like, you know, contain it or whatever they're trying to do with them, I feel like it just empowered their message more about, like, hey, we got to stand up and kind of come together for each other and support, you know, which I feel like that's been a really big thing over the last couple of weeks. People have been sharing like crazy on social media, you know, just trying to get that information out and inform the public.
Yeah. I mean, two quick comments on that. Number one, you know, we have the concept of, you know, the next person up, you know, if you're the Philadelphia Eagles over here with Michael and you're trying to get your team turned around and somebody goes down with an injury, somebody else has to step up.
Yeah.
You know, whoever the backup is has to come on and they're expected to perform because they're needed, you know, or if you're in the military and half your unit gets killed, you know, other people have to step up. And so the important thing is if however long they're going to be kept locked up without bail, other people have to step into that gap and make sure that the fact that they're trying to be silenced doesn't affect the ability of people to step up and say, we don't care, we're still gonna press on these issues because they're still important. Police brutality is important, government accountability is important. So, okay, we've lost some of our frontline people. We're gonna step up now and fill that gap. So I think that's important. And the second thing is, and I see this in a lot of the comments under some of my posts, and it's really kind of an insidious problem that creeps in when this type of case gets filed. And there's history for this. You know, you go back to the late 60s, the same thing happened in East LA, you know, with certain activists, and, you know, they were made into, you know, these crazy radical individuals who were doing nothing more than protesting injustice. So we've seen this before. We've seen this movie before. But the second point I wanted to make is I get so many people commenting, and it's really like people are divided amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden you've got this sort of backlash faction that's commenting the opposite and saying, oh, they're a bunch of fucking criminals. You know, they should be locked in there, you know, and I go to their profiles and, you know, they're Hispanic or they're Mexican and they're proud to be Mexican, but they're on there saying, oh, they're a bunch of fucking criminals.
Yeah.
And it defeats the whole purpose because now people are working at odds with one another and then nothing's going to get done. Nothing's going to get accomplished. And so I think everybody has to fight really hard against the urge to, you know, turn on each other because you become your own worst enemy with people out there that maybe don't know the depth of everything. They don't know the facts. They're not in the courtroom. They're making snap judgments on what they see on TikTok mm-hmm. about a person. And it ends up dividing people rather than everybody working together for the same goal. So I think we have to guard against that as much as we can and not let people like that become a distraction, you know?
Yeah.
I hope that makes sense.
It made sense. I understood it. So it makes a lot of sense. But no, man, well, thank you for everything you've been doing, you know?
Like I said, I through this process, I've gotten to know him a lot just in the two weeks or so I've known him. I've spoken to a lot of people that know him. They tell me about him. I've met his parents. I've spent time with them. I've spent time with his partner, and you really become invested in these individuals. And it's become a real quest to get him out of this case and to get his life back on track as much as I possibly can, given what he's hired me to do. But like I said, there's a lot of injustices that I think have gone on outside the courtroom. His job's a good example where, you know, we have to make sure we do everything we can to get his life back to where it was.
Yeah, I agree. For people to just stay up to date with you, you know, after this case, during the case, like what's the best way to get in contact with you?
Well, my Instagram is probably the most active social media platform I have right now. It's at CLFCA. So just think of Chambers Law Firm, California, CLFCA. We have a Facebook page and we talked off air. I've got my own podcast, One in the Chamber. It's not nearly as sophisticated and fancy as yours is, though. I got a lot of work to do. I got to go talk to Steve and we got to get our shit together. Our podcast is One in the Chamber. It's on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple. Our website is, you can just type in clfca.com and it'll route you to our website. I take a lot of pride in the website only because we put a lot of emphasis on putting resources on there for people. So if you go to our website, even if you don't want to hire us as your attorney, you're going to be able to find every jail, the phone numbers for those jails. You're going to be able to find all the California penal codes. You're going to be able to find the addresses to all the courthouses. You know, we take a lot of pride in like making sure that people can come to the law, to the firm website. And even if they don't want to hire us, they can find stuff that they're looking for, or if they have questions about, you know, what is the three strikes law? So we have a ton of content on there for people so that they can understand the criminal justice process. Because you said, I don't know if it was off air or on the podcast, you said, you know, you don't know anything about this. You've never been through it. And if you've never been through it before, it's incredibly overwhelming. I do it for a living, so I just assume everybody's working at my level, right? Because they do it every day. But sometimes you have to realize, hey, this person's never been through this process. They've never walked in a courthouse in their life. They've never been contacted by the police before, let alone arrested. So it's all brand new. So we take a lot of pride in making sure that everybody understands all the steps of a criminal case so that that way you might be scared, you might be nervous, you might be afraid, but you have knowledge. And once you understand the process, you can start to control your fear and like start working with us. And I tell people that all the time when they hire us. I say, look, at first you're going to be, your whole world's going to be turned upside down. All this is going to be new. It's going to be coming at you really fast. But we're going to walk through this process together. And once you learn about how it's going to go, you may be anxious still, but you've got knowledge, right?
Yeah.
And knowledge is power. You feel like, okay, I feel a little more in control. And I take a lot, it makes me feel really good when people, you know, clients will call me on the phone because they're nervous about their case. Oh, you know, I'm thinking about my court date. Let's go, what's going to happen? Or what are we doing about this? And, you know, within about 5 minutes of talking to them, they all say, oh man, I feel so much better. Yeah. You know, that means I'm doing a good job, you know? Because a lot of times people just want you to tell them, hey, you know what? I'm on top of this. We got this, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah, there's some reassurance.
Yeah, some reassurance. And for what they're paying, you know, they deserve that. Mm-hmm. They deserve that. So it was great having me on, man. Thank you for having me on. And shoot me any questions you want. And if you have questions about the case or anything, if you need a resource, I'm here.
Thank you. Thank you. And everybody else, have a good night. You know who to follow. You know who to contact.
Thanks, brother.
We'll see you next time, Dad.
Take care. Hey. Bye.